The Water Values Podcast, session 125.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things vital. Now here's your host, Dave McGibson.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey and thanks so much for joining me. We have a great show for you today. We have a full show for you today. We've got a feature interview with John Friedman of Suez Water. You may remember John from back in episode 80 when he came on and talked about some technological advancements in water treatment. Today he's here to talk about U.S. water policy with, again, his new position as the global government affairs leader with Suez Water. We also have Reese Tisdale, who returns for another Bluefield on Tap segment. And Reese is going to get into a lot of interesting stuff that's going on in the market right now, especially a really interesting details concerning San Jose Water's acquisition of Connecticut Water, the attempts by Cal Water to take over Connecticut Water, and now the hostile takeover bid that Cal Water has launched for San Jose Water. So that's a really interesting thing that's going on in the markets right now. But again, we've got a great show for you. John Friedman's terrific. Reese is terrific. And before we get to them, I want to thank you for the great ratings that you've given over since the last episode. We got another 5-star rating up there. Did not leave a review, though. So if you've been listening to the podcast and enjoying it, please leave a rating and a review. It just helps others find the podcast and explain why you like it. So without further ado, let's get to Reese Tisdale with the Bluefield on Tap segment. So here it goes. Well, Reese, welcome back to another Bluefield on Tap segment. It's finally spring, so welcome back.
Yeah, I think we finally made it.
Yeah. As we were talking earlier, you know, had the first baseball game of the season last night for Little League. So it's definitely feeling like spring finally. But so what's on your mind? What are kind of the big things that you're thinking about these days?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I've been on the road. I've actually been in Europe for a couple of weeks. And now that I'm back, trying to sort of get my head around what's happening in the U.S. and I tell you, what's interesting has come up recently. I mean, at Bluefield, we got a lot going on, but I don't know if you've seen these sort of the back and forth on the M&A activity among investor-owned utilities, particularly large investor-owned utilities. So you've got California Water Services and San Jose Water SJW Group, as well as Eversource, all vying for different positions in different markets across the country. So it's really interesting to see what's happening there.
Yeah. So can you sketch out exactly what's happening for those who may not be familiar with what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in the whole, so stepping back, looking at IOU M&A as a whole, it's something we at Bluefield track. You know, to give you an idea, there were 90 deals last year totaling about $2.2 billion total. Eversource's acquisition of Aquarion was $1.7 billion of that. So dollar-wise, it was a big chunk. But what's interesting more recently, so basically SJW out of San Jose made an offer to, an agreed-upon offer to acquire Connecticut Water. You know, so a cross-country transaction. They were going to acquire this, I think it was about $750 million acquisition. Immediately thereafter, Eversource made a challenging offer, a competing offer to acquire Connecticut Water. That was subsequently rejected. But now, just yesterday, it comes out California Water Services out of San Jose as well, who's one of the larger IOUs in the country, basically made public that it had made three offers to acquire SJW since September. And the reason it went public was because the board of directors of SJW had rejected them three times. And finally, they said, look, we're offering a better deal for your shareholders. We're going to leave it up to them and let them know what we're willing to offer. California Water Services has offered $1.9 billion to acquire SJW. And so now it's going to be up in the air to see what actually happens to all of this deal flow. Particularly for large systems, which you don't see a lot of in the U.S. market.
Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like there's a proxy fight coming up in that. And there's another interesting twist where one of the former executives for Connecticut Water, right, is the new CEO, Eric Thornburg, who was actually a guest on the Water Values podcast way back in like episode 38 or 39. So just interesting stuff about that.
Yeah, I mean, he left Connecticut Water in, I believe it was September, went over to San Jose, turned right back around this past month to make an offer for his former company. And now it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, a $1.9 billion deal is a big deal, but that would make Eversource acquiring Aquarian, San Jose or SJW acquiring Connecticut, and now we've got California Water, or Cal Water, as many call it, refer to them as, on the prowl, so to speak.
So what does this M&A activity? What's that kind of, how do you think that's impacting, say, infrastructure? Are investors looking out there saying, hey, there's going to be a lot of investment. We want to get in on that investment, and we want to get in through one of these companies? Or do you have any insights on how all this M&A activity is translating into infrastructure, the infrastructure piece of the puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, I think it raises a good point. I think these are a little bit unique in that they're, privately owned or, investor-owned utilities buying one another, these offers going back and forth. I mean, all the companies that we just talked about, that is the case. But, as I mentioned, the 90 deals last year, there is activity among particularly American Water, Aqua, and California Water and so on, these existing IUs. But there is a lot of interest and activity, and the number of whether it be private equity firms or, as we call them at Bluefield, outsiders looking in are trying to position themselves to get into the water sector. Most of the deals are small. It's a hard market to get into because if you got money burning a hole in your pocket like some of these financial players do, they're looking for a big platform. They're looking to invest because they see growth. They see opportunity, one, to make systems more efficient, but also cities and municipalities and utilities, they are in need of capital in many cases. So it's this back and forth that everybody likes to talk about. But, I think as we talked about several weeks ago or a month ago, the CapEx demands from the municipal utility sector is growing. I think we projected over $680 billion over the next 10 years just of capital expenditures forecasted. So the money's got to come from somewhere, and rates will continue to rise along with that. So companies do see M&A as a way to get into the market.
Right, right. What is Bluefield, anything else coming out from Bluefield recently or in the near future?
Yeah, I mean, it's all related to infrastructure today one way or another. But, we have an advanced asset management report coming out in the next week or so. It's pretty interesting. I think what we did is we did some analysis of 31 countries around the world, the U.S., Canada, European countries, Australia, and looking at asset management. So, basically, there's about $2.9 trillion of utility assets under management that need to be managed and maintained. And I think what's happening is that asset management is not new, but I think utilities are now under particular strain. They've got aging workforces. They're facing more climatic volatility or pressure from large storm events. And the infrastructure is getting old, particularly in these developed markets. And so they're turning to more advanced systems, whether it be hardware, software, and companies that have, alternative or unique business models to, offset some of these risks and pressure that they're facing. I think that really the magic number that we came up with is looking at all these systems and assets was that advanced asset management is expected to save about $41 billion over the next 10 years. So it could be interesting to see what happens in that space. And the competitive landscape is crazy when you look at all the logos, generally speaking, who's positioning within these utility silos, as we call them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like it might deserve its own podcast to revisit asset management back from I think it was in the early 70s. We had a Scott Haskins from CH2M Hill was on, talked about asset management. But this sounds like something that would go beyond kind of what the scope of that discussion was. But in any event, Reese, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate you taking some more time to shed some of your knowledge with us, share some of your knowledge with us. So thanks so much, and we'll see you back on the next Bluefield on Tap segment.
Fantastic. Happy baseball
season. Yeah, amen. Okay, bye, Reese. Well, as always, Reese does a great job with the Bluefield on Tap segment. That was really interesting stuff. Thanks so much for coming on, Reese, for that. Now we turn to John Friedman, who does a terrific job giving us the kind of the eagle-eye view of U.S. water infrastructure policy. He's going to go through a lot of stuff that's going on at the federal level right now and how that's filtering down to the states. And he's just going to cover a lot of ground. So that's just a little bit of what John's going to cover. So without further ado, fasten your seatbelts, open the valves, and here we go. Well, John, welcome back to the Water Values Podcast. So glad you could find time to come back and join us. Really great to have you. How you been?
Great, Dave, and thanks for having me on the Water Values Podcast.
Oh, you bet. It's been about 18 months or so since you were on back, or maybe it's probably been 2 years since you were on back in episode 80. I know that there's been a lot that's transpired for you professionally since that time. You want to tell us a little bit about what has changed in your life since you were back on the Water Values Podcast last?
Absolutely. The biggest change is that I now work for a new company. So I worked, when we spoke last time, Dave, I worked for GE Water. GE Water was one of the world's leading water treatment technology companies. It had 50,000 customers. It made membranes and other types of advanced water treatment technologies. And then on October 1st of last year, we were acquired by Suez. And for those your listeners who don't know, Suez is headquartered in Paris, and it's one of the world's leading water treatment and waste recovery companies. It has 90,000 employees and 450,000 customers, so quite a step up from what GE Water had. And GE Water, Dave, was mainly a technology company with some operations, and Suez was mainly an operations company with some technology. And so together we have this really very complementary business that is not only the world's leading water treatment technologies, but also the best operational expertise in the world.
Right. Well, so you've laid out the synergies, or at least the most obvious synergies there. What other synergies do you kind of feel like you've been able to achieve through that combination?
Well, you know, in the past, GE Water, for example, would go to the World Bank, and the World Bank would be running a procurement for a big wastewater treatment plant in Vietnam, and this is a real example. And GE Water couldn't really bid on that plant because we were just a technology provider, one piece of the puzzle, whereas the World Bank would be looking for somebody to come in and actually design the plant, build the plant, and operate the plant. And so now that's the type of thing that with Suez we can do together. So Suez is bidding on that project. It could involve former GE Water technology. And that's just one example of how together the company can really address some of the world's biggest challenges, building big water reuse plants around the world, wastewater treatment. And when we go to market, we really have a much more complete offering. And we're also, by the way, weaving in brand new technologies like digital water solutions. So it's been a great experience, not only for the employees, but also for our customers.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, let's use that as a launch pad for what we'll talk about today. And so, you've mentioned reuse a couple of times. We've obviously seen water scarcity as a challenge in the United States in certain geographic locations, and it's actually becoming a broader problem, really. With your location, you're still in the D.C. area, but what can we do from a water policy standpoint to attack this challenge of water scarcity from where you sit with Suez and with the leverage of the federal government?
and in my new role, I lead global government affairs for Suez Water Technologies and Solutions. And a couple of days ago, I spoke at the Wilson Center, which, as you know, is a think tank, and they had a summit on water sustainability. And there was a woman there from EPA, and she said that about two-thirds of the world's population lives in areas that are experiencing water scarcity at least once a month. So huge global challenge. As you just said, it's not something we here in the United States have avoided either. If you look at California, the Southwest, and now places like Florida and even New York City, in Long Island, places like Nassau County, where water scarcity is becoming a bigger challenge. And so, that's one thing, the challenge. Second is the technology to address this challenge totally exists. We have membrane filters and membranes that can cover up to 70% of wastewater, and other thermal technologies we call zero liquid discharge that can recover 99% of all wastewater. So that can be reused for things like growing crops, running power plants, or even filling drinking water reservoirs. So big challenge, the technology to address that challenge exists, but the world's only reusing 3-4% of its wastewater, and in the U.S., Dave, the Water Reuse Association says we're reusing about 8% of our wastewater. So why are we only scratching the surface of treating what in effect is a huge reservoir of wastewater that can be harnessed for productive purposes? And I think the issue is that requires the government to step in and implement some policies that can really push this forward in a big way.
Yeah. So in terms of those policies, what kind of are you what are you thinking about there?
Policies that governments around the world have already put in place to successfully promote more reuse of water. And really, at the end of the day, governments can do four main things. One is more education and outreach. In other words, explain to people that it's not only important to reuse water, but it's safe. And that's really the platform on which all other policies stand. The second thing governments can do is remove barriers to reuse. And there are lots of barriers. There are regulatory barriers where there might be a lack of clear standards, so businesses don't know what level they need to treat water to before they can use it for some industrial process safely. Or there may be pricing barriers. For example, some utilities, Dave, charge a lower price per unit of water the greater volume of water you use. Well, that, in effect, is a disincentive to water reuse. And then the third thing is incentives. So governments can provide incentives to help communities kind of bridge the economic gap they face today. And when you speak to cities across this country, one of the reasons they haven't put in place water reuse technologies is because it's simply cheaper to take more water from the ground, a river, whatever, than it is to actually begin to treat and recycle wastewater, although we're seeing that change a bit. And then the final thing is governments can simply mandate reuse, and we've seen that in areas like Alberta, Canada, in the oil sands, where they were running out of water to process this oil, and the government said, look, you have to recycle at least 90% of all the water you use in this process.
Right. So let me try and tie this into current events. We all know of the water issues in Cape Town. It seems to me from an outsider's point of view that had some of these policies been implemented, or maybe some of them were, maybe they were just implemented late. You know, how do these policies play into a situation like Cape Town? How much lead time is needed? You know, do you have any thoughts on policy implementation and averting those kinds of crises?
Wastewater and you treat it to the point where it can be reused for productive purposes as opposed to discharging into an ocean or a river, you are helping to drought-proof yourself. You are sustainably increasing your supply of water forever. And we're seeing now, California did. They just went through this tremendous drought over the past several years. And that has really spurred a lot of reuse projects in California. You see San Diego now is putting in place a program to go to direct potable reuse. If you look at the Los Angeles area, the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, and I think you had Jeff Keitlinger, who's the GM, on your show in December. They are now looking at, they're piloting a program that would take 150 million gallons a day of Los Angeles wastewater, city wastewater, and run it through membranes so that it can be reused to replenish the groundwater supply and for other purposes as opposed to just discharge into the Pacific Ocean. Those are the types of steps that will help drought-proof areas like Cape Town.
Yeah, yeah, and along those lines, I know that UCLA put out a study recently that kind of demonstrates how, as remarkable as it sounds, that Los Angeles could be, not have to import water anymore in, I can't remember if it was 50 years or by 2050, but water reuse played a big component of that, as well as stormwater, stormwater retention and treatment and things like that, but. In terms of when we're just for my purposes of clarity, when we're talking water reuse, you're talking through the wastewater treatment plant. How does stormwater play into that at all?
Yeah, sure. It absolutely could. So the same technology could be used to treat stormwater as it's used to treat wastewater. You know, one of the challenges with stormwater is you don't necessarily control, when the flow.
Yeah.
So one of the first challenges with stormwater is figuring out how to collect it and store it in an appropriate way so that you don't overrun the treatment capacity of your wastewater treatment plant. Suez and other companies, Dave, are working on solutions for that would involve using digital technology, in other words, soft sensors and software, so you can move the water around the wastewater treatment plant has the capacity to treat it.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of stuff I think is really interesting. Let's kind of dig in if we can on these four policy factors that you identified for water reuse. The first is education. The second was barriers. Third was incentives. And the fourth was mandates. From an education perspective, one of the things that I hear most often is people just say, it just has the yuck factor. So how, do you have any thoughts on getting past that? Because that's just, I think that's the initial human reaction until you really start to think about it. Well, all water that we drink has been recycled. It's all probably gone through this process multiple times. Do you have any insights or thoughts on how to attack that education process?
Wastewater to do things like grow crops. It's a non-starter. So governments have been very active in trying to figure out how to make people comfortable with this process. Singapore has led the way, Dave. They have a program they call New Water where they explain to people the technology involved. And they start, by the way, in the schools with children. And then the public officials actually drink reclaimed water so that they can demonstrate to people it's totally safe to do so. A lot of stakeholder involvement, education, and so forth. And then other governments have taken other approaches. For example, I won't say who I was meeting with, but I was meeting with a government official in Australia, and he said, we did research and stakeholder engagement and had lots of outreach, and we found that people just couldn't get comfortable with the concept. And what really worked best was just not telling people that we were, using for various purposes. So different approaches work, but the point is the water is generally safe, and it's generally good to tell people that, convince them that it is safe.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree. You want to be transparent. That's my thought. And I do think it's very smart to educate the young, the young kids so that they don't grow up, and because it's hard to teach that old dog new tricks. If we move on to the next kind of thing you identified, and those were the barriers, let's dive into that a little more. I think was one of the barriers you identified was, essentially, I think you identified price of water. How do we get over that particular barrier when it comes to implementing these systems?
Yeah, well, in the U.S., it's not particularly easy to overcome the barrier. So if you look globally, water is almost universally underpriced. And the kind of underpricing of water has meant that communities haven't necessarily had enough money to adequately invest in infrastructure. The chronic underinvestment in infrastructure over a long period of time has resulted in these great challenges we're seeing today, where the American Society of Civil Engineers last year just gave the drinking water system in the United States a grade of a D and said that water mains are breaking at the rate of 240,000 a year, which is about 650 a day. And communities simply can't keep up at this point. So it's kind of an intractable challenge. And how, when you say we have roughly 56,000 drinking water utilities across the country, many of which set their own rates, it's not like you can just flip a light switch and say, okay, we're now going to increase rates in the United States and communities will have more money. So I think it's really going to have to be a city-by-city kind of issue where they're going to have to see the need to raise rates and do so. Having said that, rates in the U.S. have been increasing, and I think communities are having more money. Now, Dave, the other thing is the federal government recognizes this is a challenge, and they're now taking steps to provide communities across the country with more federal dollars that can be used for water and wastewater infrastructure. I'm happy to talk about that.
Yeah, I'd really be interested in diving into that because really when, you know, a lot of the information you see is, hey, federal investment in water and water-related infrastructure has just taken a nosedive since the 70s, since it peaked in the 70s. And so I am interested in hearing about that. And so could you talk on that a little bit?
Yeah. So look, if you look back over the last 5 or 6 years, which is as far as I've looked, the federal government has been providing funding for communities principally through a couple of programs. One is called the State Revolving Loan Fund Program that the EPA administers, and they provide communities with money for drinking water and wastewater systems. And another is called Title 16, where the Bureau of Reclamation, which is part of the Department of Interior, provides some grant money for water recycling projects. And that money has been kind of relatively stable over the past 5 or 6 years, and there's enough federal dollars to fund about $9 to $10 billion in community projects, water and wastewater projects. This year, Dave, Congress just passed a spending bill on March 23rd that provided enough federal funding to spur about $22 billion in water and wastewater projects. So a significant increase, and we can talk about where that money is coming from. But in any event, I think the important point is that Congress recognizes we're facing an infrastructure challenge. It recognizes that communities don't necessarily have the wherewithal to deal with this on their own, and it's providing increased federal spending. The second point is that the Trump administration on February 12th released an infrastructure plan. Now, the infrastructure plan, it's not a law, but it's a statement of principles that the administration hopes Congress will use as the basis to implement a law, that a new infrastructure bill that would provide even more spending. And what the Trump administration would like to do is see the government, federal government, provide $200 billion in federal spending over the next 10 years to spur $1.5 trillion in infrastructure projects, a significant portion of which would be water and wastewater projects.
Yeah, so
and there's one, yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, John. Go ahead. Please finish your thought.
I was just going to say there's one part of that bill that would tend to provide an incentive. So $100 billion of the $200 billion would go for kind of federal incentives for communities. And the criteria for communities to succeed in getting that federal money would include an ability to raise funding from the private sector, or the state, or other sources, other non-federal sources, and an ability to show access to increased revenues. And the way you get increased revenues is by raising your tariffs. So anyway, the federal government, at least in this Trump infrastructure plan, is trying to incentivize communities to increase their tariffs and also turn to the private sector to unleash some of that capital that's been on the sidelines there.
Yeah, so you've said a lot of interesting things there. First off, I want to dive into all this money that's being made available by Congress. How is that going to filter down? Some of it goes through state revolving funds. What are the other mechanisms to get that money out into the marketplace and get these projects done?
Right. So the state revolving loan funds administered by EPA, Congress increased each of those by about 20% for fiscal year 2018. That money will go to the states and from the states to the communities, the cities, or public water agencies. The other kind of areas of funding are, I mentioned this Title 16 program with the Bureau of Reclamation. That got its funding more than doubled. That gets administered by the Department of Interior. And it goes to the states and then in turn from the states to the communities for reuse projects. And then the biggest piece of this is called WIFIA, which stands for Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act. And this program, Dave, it is modeled on an analogous transportation program called TIFIA. But in effect, what it means is the federal treasury will actually lend money directly to communities for water and wastewater projects at extremely low interest rates. This program just got significantly increased and would account for about $11 billion of that $22 billion I mentioned in projects being spurred by the federal spending this year.
Got it. Now, in terms of, and I'll kind of like pivot to one of the things you indicated, one of the bullets you had on reuse, which was incentives. Is that money, I don't want to say priority, but are projects like scored on kind of water reuse? Is that one of the factors that will help? So, you know, essentially creating a resilient water supply, is that one of the, will that help you, you know, push it up to scale? Regionalization, I think, might be another, you know, scoring factor that could help push your project up to scale that could potentially make it, potentially win some of those funds.
One extremely large wastewater reuse project in Southern California that has just applied for a huge slug of WIFIA funding. So I know that reuse facilities can apply for the funding, but I don't know what the criteria is.
Okay. So one of the other things I wanted to get to, and you, I think you hinted at it, and that was leveraging the federal investment to get the private sector involved. And can you speak to larger private sector involvement in the water industry?
Absolutely. So first of all, there is a ton of private sector money that would love to be deployed into water and wastewater infrastructure. There are private equity firms, there are infrastructure firms, there are pension plans, all looking to invest in water and wastewater infrastructure because it's considered a relatively safe investment. And the problem has been that a lot of this money remains on the sidelines, even though we have this tremendous challenge to rebuild and upgrade the infrastructure. One of the reasons is because the returns that the private sector is looking for may be higher than communities are willing to pay, because when communities can get access to federal dollars or, you know, at very low rates, that's more attractive than turning to the private sector. But there are a couple programs that will open up opportunities for the private sector. And this WIFIA program that we just discussed is one of those, because WIFIA only provides 49% of the funding for a project. So the other 51% has to come from somewhere, and that's a big opportunity for the private sector. So I do expect to see a big bump in private sector investment in water over the next year or 2 years. Second is there's something called private activity bonds, which we haven't touched on, but private activity bonds are essentially a private sector analog to municipal bonds. It allows a private sector company to access tax-exempt debt. As long as the money is being used to serve a public purpose, a water treatment plant, a wastewater treatment plant, et cetera, those are considered public purposes. So right now, private activity bonds exist, but there's a cap on the amount each year that can be issued. And there's an effort from a policy standpoint underway to remove that cap, which again would spur a lot more private sector involvement in the water sector because it would bring down the cost of capital for the private sector to a level similar to what communities have.
Sure, sure. And when we're talking about private sector investment, can I mean, I've had a one of the things I'd like to explore is what that looks like. Is that kind of the development of and implementation of P3s or public-private partnerships, or is it acquisition of systems with promises to undertake significant capital improvements? What when we talk about private sector investment in the water industry, what does that look like?
Yeah, well, it's all of the above. So for one thing, you could have private sector look to acquire a water treatment technology company. That's one type of involvement. You could have a private sector company look to pursue a concession with a community. Now, that's where you might give a city like Bayonne, New Jersey, which is a real example. I'm making up the numbers, but give them $100 million up front for the right to operate their water system for the next 20 or 25 years. The city could then use the money to address its pension obligations or other financial challenges it has. And in exchange for that, it gives this private sector company the opportunity to run and upgrade the water system and so forth over an extended period of time. Or you could have a public-private partnership model, which just involves, you know, where the private sector comes in and agrees to operate a system for a period of time, an O&M contract. There's a whole spectrum of approaches, but there are a number of projects that are being bid today. One is in Santa Clara, California. Another is in Corpus Christi, Texas, where there are teams of private sector water treatment operating companies and also private sector financial companies bidding to come in and operate systems for a long period of time.
Got it. All right. So the other thing, do you when you look out at the water sector and getting private investment, you mentioned a lot of private capital that's sitting on the sidelines. Is all that capital with, you know, expertise or knowledge behind it? And let me give you a little background on why I'm asking that, because I've been approached by certain people who just kind of say, look, I have a client that has a big pile of money. They want to get into the water sector. How do they do it? And I always kind of chuckle on, I think the barriers to entry, you gotta know what you're talking about. You gotta know what you're doing. And so I'm just kind of curious about what your perception is of all that capital that's on the sideline. Is it capital that's knowledgeable, that has the expertise, that's ready to be deployed, or is that capital that's just kind of trying to find a way in, even though it may not have that expertise?
Well, it's a mixed bag, Dave. There are some firms that are specific to the water industry, so they have a tremendous amount of knowledge about you know, who the key players are and what the current project pipeline is, and so they're very kind of wired in to the process. Then there are other firms that have capital and are saying, look, this is an attractive space, we want to get into it. And typically those firms would hire or bring on board a water operating partner. So they'd have financial experts who can structure the investments, you know, optimally. And then they have kind of somebody who really knows the water industry inside and out, has a great set of relationships that they can leverage for business development. And we really kind of see both approaches.
Got it. I think that's a great answer. In terms of how do we, you know, are there other strategies that we can use to kind of to get the private sector? I know return is a big deal for the private sector, but if we can, are there other strategies we can use to continue to try and get the private sector into the water sector to attack all these problems we've been talking about today?
The main thing is some type of policy approach that will encourage more private sector investment. Canada, for example, has actually provided a federal incentive to communities that enter into public-private partnerships, so and which I understand has been very successful. So I think it's a question of the federal government, or in some cases state governments, putting policies in place that will make it more attractive for communities to reach out to the private sector.
Yeah.
And other than that, it's kind of all the things we've already discussed, private community bonds with the Trump infrastructure plan with its kind of incentive fund, that kind of thing.
Right. And I guess my final substantive question would be along the lines of, you know, how's EPA, you know, the US EPA, how are they kind of, you know, what's their role in all this? How are they reacting to the needs of the water sector?
Yeah, well, EPA has a huge role in water infrastructure. Most people, I think most people view EPA as really a regulatory agency, and clearly they play an important regulatory role in protecting the environment and ensuring that water is safe to drink. But beyond that, they're really, in my view, the principal agency in the federal government responsible for implementing infrastructure growth plans. And that they do that right now because they administer the State Revolving Loan Fund program and the WIFIA program. And so EPA is really in the forefront of addressing our nation's water and wastewater infrastructure challenges.
Yeah, yeah. Before I ask you my final question, I'll just say, look, you know, John, what have I failed to ask that you think is important that you want to get across to the audience? You know, what do you, when you look out and kind of survey the water sector, what have I failed to ask that you think is important for people to hear?
I don't think you failed to ask anything, Dave, but one thing I always hear the same thing. People talk about the huge scarcity challenge we're facing, and we've spent a fair amount of time talking about that as well. And you know, in my view, yeah, sure, it's a challenge, but it's absolutely solvable. And it's really a question of having the right policies in place that will take these technologies that exist today and get them deployed to help drought-proof, you know, the country and the world. And so I think there's a very bright future ahead of us.
Yeah. Well, John, I really appreciate your time. You've been absolutely fantastic today. Someone with your insights, you know, tapping into that knowledge and those insights, I think is really valuable. And I really want to thank you for coming on. You know, for those who want to find out more about you and Suez, where can they go to find that information? Nice and easy. All right. Fantastic. Well, John, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Dave. Uh-huh.
Bye. Well, I hope you liked that interview with John Friedman. He was fantastic. Again, I really appreciate John coming on again. You know, we've kind of stayed in contact through his switch over from GE Water with it being acquired by Suez Water. And it's been interesting to hear how things have gone with him. And he's just, again, he's just doing a great job over at Suez. So thank you so much, John, for coming on. And I would love to hear what you thought about that interview with John. So please leave him some comments on the show notes. You can check those out at thewatervalues.com/pod125. You can also tweet about the podcast at my handle, which is at DTM1993. You can tweet about the podcast using the hashtag watervalues. You can also email me at david@thewatervalues.com. Sometimes I'm slow to respond, so I apologize for that. Just be patient. I will eventually get to you. Sorry for those who's it's taken me a long time to get to you. And finally, I'd like to just say, let's help me get to 100 ratings by the end of the year, by the end of calendar year 2018. We're at 78 now, so just a couple of weeks, and we will get there. So please leave a rating and a review at Apple Podcasts. Would greatly appreciate it. And if you'd like to support the Water Values Podcast, you can do so by going to thewatervalues.com, scrolling down, and you'll see a little PayPal button. Just click on that. Any denomination is much appreciated, and it helps defray the cost of putting on the podcast. So in closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business, Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
You've been listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Thank you for tuning into the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and this podcast does not establish an attorney-client relationship with you or anyone else. Information in this podcast should not be considered legal advice. Further, this podcast is not a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer who finds water issues interesting and who believes greater public education about water issues is necessary. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.